Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And as you know, if you are a regular listener, one of the things that we've been following pretty closely since the recession and credit crunch began is student loans. Just as the crisis forced Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme into the sunlight, it has also brought to light some abuses, many of them legal, it's sad to say, that have pushed students into higher interest and more inflexible loans than they should need to be in. Excuse me, there's also the plain old solvency problems some student lenders are having, making good loans harder to get. And now comes word in a New York Times article that some students who enter loan forgiveness programs in exchange for going into teaching or other public service jobs may not actually get their student loans forgiven. But there is a new law taking effect on July 1st that's going to be good for a lot of students and former students. So joining us with the latest and the big picture on all these things is Mark Dannenberg from the New America Foundation's Higher Ed Watch blog, and he is back with us for this. I'm sorry, I said Mark, you're Michael. Michael, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Let's begin with this student loan forgiveness program. How do these work?
There are hundreds, actually more than 2,000 student loan providers nationwide. Students choose which loan provider they're going to go to, often on the recommendation of their institution of higher education. The loan providers have various benefits that they offer. These, generally speaking, are not governed by federal law. And as an inducement to get students to borrow from that particular lender, or in the case of nonprofits that are state affiliated to work in certain occupations, they will provide benefits such as the loan forgiveness program that you mentioned.
And is the loan forgiveness part in jeopardy in some states, even for students or graduates who keep their end of the bargain and go into teaching or whatever the professions are?
Yes and no. There are different types of loan forgiveness programs. There's a federal loan forgiveness program, which is not in jeopardy whatsoever. However, individual lenders in individual states have separate loan forgiveness programs that are not governed by federal law. And in some cases, we're seeing lenders pull back on their promises. Now, the borrowers affected in places like Kentucky, for example, say, hey, we had a contract. This is an ironclad guarantee. The lender's response is, no, we never had a contract. We never had an ironclad guarantee. And they'll probably fight it out in the courts. Our blog, higheredwatch.org, at the New America Foundation, has been covering this at length. And what we found is it's an expert blog, which means it doesn't have the wide readership of, say, Talking Points Memo. But our posts on this particular issue have generated the most comments, the most responses of any of our posts, and it's generally from dissatisfied borrowers who are in teaching.
So you mean there are people who think they have an ironclad guarantee that they made a deal, that they will go into teaching for X number of years in exchange for student loan forgiveness, but really what they got was a probably?
Well, that's what their lenders are saying, and that's true of thousands of borrowers out there who are now teachers in public service occupations. Again, this is sort of state by state, lender by lender. But at the federal level, the rules are pretty consistent. And as you mentioned in your opener, there are some big changes that are coming at the federal level that can be of help to these folks who are being cut loose by some of their state lenders and can be of help to all borrowers wherever they took out their loan and, in fact, whatever occupation they're in.
And we'll get to those rule changes that take effect nationally on July 1st. But do the state problems affect any of the states in our listening area? I know Kentucky was prominently featured in that New York Times article that's now generating all these comments on your website. Mm-hmm. Are New York or New Jersey or Connecticut in any trouble here?
Well, New York for the time being appears to be okay. New York has a loan forgiveness program for district attorneys, nurses and teachers, and its funding is set by the state. They have funding for the current year. Going forward in 2010, we'll see. What happens is a lot of states raid these nonprofit state-affiliated entities for financing, and those entities in turn cut back on their loan forgiveness promises. The most disheartening example of, dare I say, mismanagement in our area is probably the Connecticut Student Loan Foundation. The Connecticut Student Loan Foundation announced, I believe, last week that they were going to be suspending all loan payments going forward. Their state auditor turned out a report a few weeks ago finding that there was consistent deficit spending at the Connecticut Student Loan Foundation, while at the same time lavish executive compensation and perks. So you had executives and board members going to Big East basketball games, golf tournaments, limousine rides. This sort of mismanagement-like behavior has been kind of rife throughout the nonprofit student loan industry. So what we have here is mismanagement and, frankly, in many cases, corruption. It seems what's happened is a lot of the bad behavior by for-profit lenders, Sallie Mae, Nelnet, when it comes to excessive billing or overbilling the federal government, mismanagement, hyper-leveraging, and very high executive compensation has bled over into the nonprofit sector.
And we can take some phone calls from anyone on a student loan forgiveness program. If you're in one as a current student or as a former student who is now in teaching or nursing or as a district attorney, ADA or whatever, 212-433-WNYC. Have you had any trouble keeping your end of this bargain? Has the state had any trouble keeping their end of this bargain? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or anything else that you want to ask Michael Dannenberg from the New America Foundation and their Higher Ed Watch blog, 212-433-9692, or post a comment or question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Tell us more about what takes effect on July 1st.
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty exciting. There's something called income-based repayment that's going to take effect July 1st. Basically, students who are borrowers, those who have old loans and are out of school or new borrowers who have just taken on loans, are going to be able to cap their student loan interest payment as a function of their income. A rule of thumb is basically that for students borrowers who opt into this system, they will not have to pay more than 10% of their income for student loans. That's a rule of thumb. It's a sliding scale. It's actually capped at 15% of income, but you pay nothing for your first 150% of poverty level of income. But a rule of thumb is basically 10% cap. You have to opt in, but it's an enormous benefit. It doesn't matter what type of occupation you're going into or are in currently. After 25 years, your loans will be forgiven. People can find out a lot more information about income-based repayment at a website called ibrinfo.org. Congress created this new social insurance program last year, and it kicks in on July 1.
I think one of the big things about student loans in general that we've talked about before and that more people are beginning to realize is that the system has inefficiencies and it has biases which drive families toward more expensive private loans rather than the lower cost direct federal loans. But President Obama is proposing to change this in some way, too, isn't he?
President Obama's proposed, I think, the most historic changes in the student loan system in at least 15 years and arguably longer. He's proposed to get rid of the private lenders and these nonprofit lenders who have the hodgepodge of loan forgiveness programs that they don't always uphold the bargain on. And he just wants the government to take over all federal student loans. So everyone would pay the same, everyone would have the same set of benefits. Taxpayers would save approximately $100 billion over the course of 10 years. And Obama would take all that savings and drive it into increased grant aid. So he's proposed major, major changes. The private loan issue is separate from the federal loan issue, and I think that's important to keep in mind. Many people take out private loans when they should take out a federal student loan first. Everyone is eligible for a federal student loan. They are cheaper. They are safer.
But everyone is eligible? Every student?
Every student's eligible for an unsubsidized Stafford loan with an interest rate that is capped currently at 6.8%. You see private loan interest rates that reach 20% a year with a 10% of principal upfront fee. Private loans are dangerous business.
If everyone's eligible for a Stafford, why does anyone take those private loans?
A couple of reasons. First, there's a limit on how much you can borrow for a Stafford loan. For undergraduate families, You can borrow up to $31,000 over the course of your undergraduate career as a student. The family can borrow a minimum of $57,000 in federal student loans over the course of an undergraduate year, a career. Some people need more than that, and they will go to private loans. People will go to private loans if, say, they are undocumented and not eligible. They may go to private loans because their families don't want to borrow more on top of that $31,000 limit for the student. And often they go to private loans because it's easy. And you see the commercials, you go on the websites, click here, loan approved in 5 minutes, and there is no requirement that a student exhaust their federal student loans before they take on that private
loan. That's such great information, and it's probably the third time you've been on this program in the last 6 months giving it, but you know, we could say it every week because so many families fall for these things, and we've also learned about outrageous weasel deals, really, that colleges have with banks in some cases to push students toward loans that are not the best deals.
That's right. First of all, 25% of all students who have a private loan have untapped federal student loan eligibility. So 1 out of 4 private loan borrowers should be exhausting their federal loans first. As for these arrangements between the lenders and the schools, this is something that our blog Higher Ed Watch uncovered along with New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, where there were kickbacks and cash payments and other quid pro quo arrangements between lenders and schools to drive students to a particular lender and, in some cases, a particular loan product. What you see in this industry is a lot of corruption, a lot of mismanagement, and, frankly, predatory lending. Obama's plan would wipe much of that out by having the federal government take over the federal student loan program.
Does it have obstacles in Congress?
Sure it does. And the largest obstacle, of course, are the lenders. The for-profit lenders are very much affiliated with the Republican Party. They're the number one campaign contributors to the Congressional Campaign Committee. And the nonprofit lenders have been raising arguments that that this will cost jobs if the Obama plan goes into effect. In many ways, it's sort of a petri dish for what's happening in healthcare, where there's talk of a public option, right? In the student loan system, we have private providers, we have nonprofit providers, and then the federal government has its own small direct loan program. Obama wants that direct loan program to take over the other providers. In healthcare, we have private providers, we have nonprofit providers, and now there is talk of trying to create a public option in terms of providing healthcare. And the great fear of the insurance companies and other providers in healthcare is that really that's a Trojan horse for a single-player plan that will take over, just like what's happening in the education field.
Is it? Are they in each case?
In the healthcare case, I mean, certainly it is the aspiration of many who back a public option for there to be a single-player healthcare system. I don't think this is any surprise to the forces aligned in the healthcare fight, and we've seen those same forces at work in the education fight.
And it's interesting that you relate those two, because I know you used to be an aide to Senator Edward Kennedy, who is the driving force in the Senate behind that public health care insurance option. Michael Dannenberg, my guest on WNYC, founder of the New America Foundation's Education Policy Program and their Higher Ed Watch blog. And we have lots of calls coming in on student loan forgiveness programs. So let's take one from Noah in Brooklyn. Noah, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I graduated in social work. I was offered a job, and they told me that they will forgive my loan at a rate of 10% for every single year I worked there. After 1 year of clinical social work at my job, I said, okay, guys, pay off my 10%. They said, well, you have to work a full year, so wait the next year. At the end of the next year, they said, well, you weren't licensed this year, and that was the third year. Every single year, they have more or less pushed me off, and I've been working here for 4 or 5 years, and they have not paid off my loan at all.
Wow. Well, anything he can do? Is this in your bailiwick?
Well, I don't know enough about the circumstances. This is a loan forgiveness program by the employer. Is it a loan forgiveness program by the lender? I can tell you at the federal level, there is a public service loan forgiveness program, which would include social work. It covers loans that have been taken out after October 1 of 2007. You have to make 120 payments over the course of 10 years, and it doesn't have to be consecutive, while in a full-time public service occupation. And at the end of those 120 payments, whatever's left over is wiped out, forgiven, and not taxable. So one of the ways to deal with this hodgepodge of loan forgiveness programs varying administration is for the feds to take over the full federal student loan program and for people to borrow federal student loans over private loans.
Tyrone in Mount Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tyrone.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Hi, Michael. I was calling because I work for a nonprofit for about 3 years, and I heard about the loan forgiveness program, and when I went to HR, I was told to call Salome, which holds my loans. When I called Salome, Salome told me that basically that I would either have to convert my loans to a different carrier, which would be out of Salome's hand for me to get that, or I'd have to make this 120 payments. And I wanted to see, I said to them after I did the calculation, if I made 120 payments, then pretty much I would pay off all my loans and I would not have much for you to forgive anyway. So I wanted to find out how does that work.
Yeah, I have a couple of responses. Calls like this are always scary because everyone's got an individual situation. I'm not sure I can handle them all, but I think I have an answer for you. With respect to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program that I mentioned to the previous caller and that is in place now, you're right. Borrowers with loans with Sallie Mae and other lenders who are not the federal government have to convert their loans into the federal direct loan program and enter into something called income contingent repayment. At the end of 120 payments through the income contingent repayment system and the direct loan program, if you're doing a public service occupation, your debt will be forgiven. That is a cumbersome process and better than nothing, but not very good. The better process is going to kick in on July 1st, I think, and that is this income-based repayment plan for everyone, regardless of who you have a loan with. And you can get information about it at again, ibrinfo.org. You don't have to change your loan holder. Sallie Mae can convert your loan to income-based repayment, and your payments will be capped.
Tyrone, good luck. And Darshan in Queens, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Darshan.
Good morning, Brian Laird. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a regular listener. This is quite interesting to me because I graduated as a physician with $200,000-plus loan, which is normal for all the physicians. Now I'm finishing my postgraduate training in a few weeks, matter of fact. And, you know, repayment is a big issue. Reimbursement in terms of physician has gone down drastically. I wanted to ask Michael if he knows programs for physicians where they will do the repayment for the service and the salary, and which state has more options and better options in terms of physicians, because New York apparently doesn't, I mean, at least New York City and surrounding doesn't have much of an option.
And this would be a factor for you, Darshan. You might decide where to practice medicine based on where you could get a student loan forgiveness.
I mean, Brian, see, at this point, I'm 32. I have 200-plus loans. These are all unsubsidized federal Stafford loans with Sallie Mae, and I'm just starting my career. Pediatricians don't make the big bucks like surgeons or plastic surgeons make.
And Darshan, I'm going to leave it there, but I asked Darshan not to accuse him, but really to exemplify that these loan forgiveness programs really can provide incentives for people to do needed work, work needed by society. And Michael, we've got a minute left, and then we're out of time.
Well, Darshan, we only have a minute left, so what I'm going to recommend you do is take a look at the Department of Health and Human Services website. Most of the physician loan forgiveness programs are run through HHS. A rule of thumb when it comes to student loans is that for every $20,000 in debt, you're going to have to pay about $200 a month. So you can do the math, $200 to $250. So you can do the math on how much is owed. There's no question that when it comes to professional students, students who are going to professional schools, it's going to affect their career choices.
Michael Dannenberg from the New America Foundation and their Higher Ed Watch blog. Great information, as always. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Now, with the chaos in Albany, they have actually managed to convene a session of the Senate, and Pedro Espada, the Democrat who defected to the Republicans and has been named president of the Senate, is now speaking on the Senate floor. Let's go live to Albany and listen in.
And says that this chamber, this august chamber, what happens here is looked upon, is judged. But I must draw your attention to some of the things that have happened outside of here and written about this chamber. Intimidation, perhaps even criminal intimidation, harassment. My home was broken into. Burglarized. My character has been assassinated. My record has been distorted. But my mission, my purpose, has not been derailed or deflated. I came up here elected by Democrats and Republicans. Yes, like Senator Monserrat, I'm a Democrat. That is my registration. My obligation is when I raise my hand and take an oath of office to serve all of the citizens of this state as a senator and as of Monday as president pro tem. The kinds of robocalls that are going on now, the kinds of, if you could call that citizen participation, where some people today have been injured, has no place in government. Yet, I respect it, but we will not be dissuaded, deflated, or derailed by that kind of intimidation. I stand steadfast here to do my job. I, too, call for matters of import to this state to be called, debated, and decided on this floor. I'll be meeting with my colleague and partner in government to discuss an active list that could include matters such as same-sex marriage. My views on that are a matter of record. But we must vote that. We must give that voice and debate, vote it up, vote it down. Then we would have done our job. In the previous conference meetings that I attended, everything was a matter of keeping three or four people in the room, deciding the outcome of legislation, holding member items yes. over the head of members. And again, that kind of political extortion yeah, is over. It's yeah. over because for the moment, two brave Democrats joined a mission worthy of support, coalition government. I again stay steadfast, committed to this. I will not be dissuaded or denied, neither will this chamber, and neither will this coalition government. Thank you very much.
Pedro Espada, referring to himself as one of two brave Democrats and referring to the new majority in Albany as coalition government. It is a coalition of 30 Republicans, all 30 Republicans in the chamber, and the two Democrats who left their caucus to vote for the Republican majority leader, those two, Pedro Espada himself and Hiram Monserrat of Queens. And Espada, who has been fined more than $60,000 for failing to disclose his campaign contributions, who is under investigation by the state attorney general for whether a nonprofit group he founded misappropriated money, and by the Bronx district attorney, who's investigating whether his primary residence is even in the Bronx, Pedro Espada, one of the two defecting senators, to forge this new coalition. And there you heard him speaking for the first time as president of the Senate, with Senate Majority Leader Republican Dean Skelos above him, but giving him that at least ceremonial position of president. We, of course, will continue to follow these developments in Albany throughout the day on WNYC. You can continue to watch the session in Albany live, if you prefer, on our website. That's our news blog at wnyc.org/news. And we will continue with other things. We wanted to bring you, though, Pedro Espada's first words as president of the New York State Senate, and we had it there live. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.